In 1812, we were just sitting around, minding our own business, putting crops into the ground.
We heard the soldiers coming, and we didn't like that sound.
So we took a boat to Washington and burned it to the ground.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is June 7th, 2018, and this is episode 89. Politicoast is your weekly politics recap with a West Coast perspective. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, leave a review wherever you found us. We're up to 41 reviews now. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott Delaneboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield, and today we're crammed into a tiny Vancouver Public Library recording room. On today's episode, it seemed like not a lot actually happened this week, so we're going to do a bit of a potpourri episode of quick takes. Some stuff on the pipeline, some stuff on electoral reform, the latest fronts in the ongoing trade war, reports from the front lines, as it were, and just random other stories that have come up. First, though, we have to thank our premier sponsors, as always, Lindsay Tedds and Blake Hodson. Thanks for helping make this show possible. A slight update. We're still in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newspaper dedicated exclusively to BC politics, and you can still get a free two-week trial to get unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. But we have a new code for you. Listeners to Politicoast get a special deal if you use the code CITIZEN, all lowercase. Use that to get your special rate after your free two-week trial, and hopefully you enjoy the newsletter. It's how we keep up with what's going on in this province. To sign up, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. And two more bits of housekeeping. First, shameless self-plug about this live show that we're doing for the Canby Report on Monday, June 11th at the Emerald Room, 7 p.m. roughly, doors at 6. Already almost 100 people have RSVP'd on Facebook, which is good. Worrying almost when it gets high, but there'll be plenty of room. So come out for that. We're almost lined up a few guests. The other thing I want to shout out is we've had a book list on our website for a while. You started this.
Yes. Early on in the podcast, I threw together a list of some of the books and whatnot that sort of influenced my thinking and threw it off on the website. But now we've decided to actually put a proper Amazon affiliate link in there.
Well, first I added my own list of books, but more just the ones that I've been reading this year as I've been taking full advantage of, I guess, Vancouver Public Library's ebook selection.
I should probably go back and update that because it's at least a year out of date for me.
There you go. So if you click through any of those links and buy anything on Amazon, I think, we get a tiny kickback. And if we get enough kickbacks, we might actually get money out of that. It's not a great system, but if you're going to buy through Amazon, anyway, we buy a lot of gear through Amazon, and we should probably have been using our own affiliate link. How does that work? Anyway, go to our website, politicoast.ca, find the book list, and check that out. We also have a list of Canadian politics podcasts that's fairly up to date, but I feel like they're expanding so fast that we almost don't need it anymore.
Everyone seems to be getting in on it, which is good. More competition, which we always like.
All right. Well, let's jump into talking about a bit of everything. First, we only talked about the pipeline in our emergency podcast last week, in the start of last week when it was nationalized. And there have been some updates since then. Nothing actually very major, but we thought we'd check in on how Canada's new pipeline's doing. I guess new old pipeline. First up, there have been a couple polls on the decision to nationalize it and what people think about throwing money after it. A couple pollsters were out there just prior to the purchase and the deal being announced. I think Research Co. was finding that people didn't really like the idea of throwing money after the pipeline, particularly around the idea of backstopping it and indemnifying some of the risks. And now that they bought it out, I think Insights West was out there saying only 33% were supportive of the deal, and it's maybe polarizing the electorate a little bit.
Yeah, think it is for sure. I mean, I've definitely heard a lot of people be very pissed off about it. But then, you know, that's my BC bubble. On the other hand, Alberta seems to be quite liking what's going on with it. Even if it does put the UCPs there in a bit of a weird ideological position where they're now quasi pro-nationalization.
It was a somewhat no-win situation for Trudeau. He'd banked a lot of his political capital on this pipeline and had been arguing essentially that this is the only way to make it happen, and he has to make it happen for the good of the country and our climate plan, however he squares that circle. But it was clear that the corporate interests weren't going to push it through because they didn't feel they had enough certainty. And so he didn't really have many choices. And so he didn't want to walk away from it, so he had to buy it. And I think it's just one of those projects where people are happy to see it happen. They like the idea of the jobs, the economy, we get all that. But when the government is directly investing like that, like the arguments you brought up last time on, is this the most efficient job creation strategy, if that's what it's going to be?
No, it really, like, you just break down the numbers of how many jobs you get for how much money being spent. Yeah, it's not a very great system, or at least direct jobs. You know, you did argue spillover effects, but even then, you can do a lot with the $12+ billion we're going to end up spending on this.
I guess a saving grace for Trudeau could be if they find a buyer fairly quickly. If someone moves through within the summer to take it over and the government doesn't actually end up losing much or any money on it, then it's kind of problem solved. That's best way out. But if the long-term political reality is that this pipeline is now in the government of Canada's hands and becomes a toxic asset.
But that asset will, turns out, be owned by Export Development Canada, which it was announced this week. They're going to be the Crown Corporation handling the pipeline purchase. So I guess we now have a little more clarity on that. So there was some speculation about whether or not a new Crown Corporation would get spun off and handle the pipeline. It looks like it's being just put under one of the existing ones.
I guess that makes sense. It means they don't have to hire an entire new staff to run this, although there's a job creation strategy.
Yeah, although it'll also help the Liberals that they won't have some bad headline about, you know, whatever the new CEO is going to be making.
And whatever connection he has to the Federal Liberal Party.
Because it's the Federal Liberal Party. They will be a big connection with whoever gets appointed.
Every party kind of does it, but, you know, it gets pointed
out. The Liberals
more so. Yeah. The better news for the Liberals, though, is they had a couple, or the pipeline had a couple wins in court recently. The BC Supreme Court has expanded the injunction at the terminals against some of the protesters.
So basically the protesters had very carefully read the previous injunction, found a few loopholes, and were using that to protest in violation of the spirit of the injunction at the very least. So Kinder Morgan went back to court and said, hey, can we kind of patch these loopholes? And court said yes.
It's technical ruling, but I'm sure people are already pouring over to find other loopholes, or else they moved their protest sites 6 meters back or whatever change. The other ruling was at the Federal Court of Appeal, where the Tsleil-Waututh Nation had been trying to bring in evidence on its ongoing case about whether Ottawa had predetermined the outcome of the hearings on this. And this followed reports, I think, in the National Observer, that there were emails going around the departments being like, find a way to get to yes. And there's like one or two of those that look bad for the government. The Tsleil-Waututh Nation wanted to bring these into court because then they can say, look, they had the answer. But you can't usually introduce evidence at higher levels of court. So the Court of Appeal was like, no, you should have done that before. So loss for the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, but the Court of Appeal still has to look at the substance of the claim. This was just, can we look at this thing? And they went, no. Now they still have to decide the actual case. So two court updates, but there's still lots more in the works, undoubtedly. Well, and while they did well in court, Kinder Morgan got some less good press when their president, Ian Anderson, and the vice president of the Trans Mountain Pipeline Expansion Project, David Safari, got $1.5 million bonuses each for this sale. It kind of makes it look like, hey, this sale that was the only way out for them on the pipeline was just a way to line their own pockets. That's $3 million of our money that just went into their pockets.
Yeah, well, I think it was worse for the government rather than Kinder Morgan because, hey, these guys just offloaded what was looking like a dead weight around the company's neck. So, you know, from a are they doing a good job for the company point of view, you could argue it was a justified bonus, if you know, if you feel $1.5 million is justified as a bonus. But like, you know, there's an argument, and I believe it was consistent with Kinder Morgan's internal policies on bonuses, that yeah, it's, you know, close a big deal like that, there's a bonus involved for the key players.
Yeah, lots of Canadian tax dollars flowing into this pipeline before a drop of oil will.
Well, moving on to provincial news, minor follow-up here. The electoral reform questions we talked about the other week have been approved by Cabinet, so we're cleared that very minor procedural hurdle and are going ahead.
I was looking here to see if Cabinet might do any tweaks, because David Eby's report came following his consultations. It was done in his own little purportedly nonpartisan bubble, but the Liberals point out that he's a New Democrat through and through who supports proportional representation.
You can only get so nonpartisan in a minister's office.
Yeah. So the option was there for Horgan and Cabinet to adopt some of the recommendations, others change them, do whatever they want. And I think they smartly just went, no, we're just going to take this as is. He did all the hard work on this. Let's send it over to Elections BC and let them do their work of printing ballots and mailing them out. And so it looks like we'll have our campaign officially running on July 1st, like was in the recommendations. And that'll be our big topic over the summer, despite what some people have said, like the premier. I think people will want to talk about proportional representation over the barbecues, or at least the kind of people I go to barbecues with.
Yes, and you know, we'll also provide the public service that apparently Google was supposed to be offering of actually telling people what these systems are. And we were lining up a couple interviews on that. But
what do you mean Google? The Google,
okay.
According to Horgan.
So for those of you who missed this news, earlier today he was asked about whether or not it was too complicated, and he referred people to Google, which is never a great answer.
There's information out there, but there's actually not much on this rural-urban system, yes. Since it was literally invented for this. I think
it got floated federally for the...
A little bit, but the specific model they came up with.
Yeah, I was at a Joyce Murray event back when the federal government was not very sincerely looking at the proportional representation thing. And yeah, it was one of the things discussed there. So it isn't entirely new, but it's still new enough that, you know, people don't know what it is. And as a general rule, you shouldn't be telling people to just Google something unless it is one of the most obvious and well-known facts, and you're doing it to dismissively tell someone to go away.
Well, I did see that Justin McElroy is working on a video or explainer or something, so that'll be exciting. The other thing I just wanted to touch on electoral reform, one of the things I meant to bring up last week when we were discussing the committee's recommendations is one of the ones that got buried in there was that there should be possibly, and this can be decided by the committee that studies it later, specific seats set aside for Indigenous communities. So the idea would be if we're expanding the legislature and having a few more representatives and people dedicated to under any of these systems, either specific ridings or at large, then a couple could be elected to represent the various Indigenous communities and bring those voices in a very explicit way into the legislature. And this, I think, is something that New Zealand did when they did their electoral reform as a way to represent the Maori and a few other peoples. I think it's kind of a good idea. It's a really interesting way to try to say these voices aren't always heard, especially when you have a large Indigenous community in Vancouver, but they're disparate over a number of ridings and none of them strong enough to win a vote. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes. And I know I'm going to be following that, even though that subplot, as it were, will probably be subsumed by the PR specifics. One of the other questions that came up for John Horgan this week was Global News reported on this meeting that he and Andrew Weaver had where they ran into representatives of this Victoria-based company called Certn. And like any good tech company, it drops a bunch of vowels, so it's CRTN. And they talked to them and were like, oh, this sounds like a great thing. And what Certn pitched itself as was a matchmaking service for roommates, essentially. And that sounds cool, maybe, except it turns out it kind of is more about landlords scanning potential tenants' social media profiles and deciding whether to accept them or not based on that.
Yeah, so that's not good at all. Probably violates the Privacy Act, or at least the Privacy Commissioner thinks it's worth looking into. And yeah, it's just weird and a little creepy.
And it also has a personality test.
Yeah, that's the thing that actually caught the most attention was personality tests, which
There's not much good science behind those.
Yeah, there's not good science behind there, and you shouldn't be denied a place to live because whatever the random questions are, you know.
Because you're too extroverted?
Yeah, something like that. You know, it's...
Sorry, you're an Int J. We don't like your kind in this building. It seems like a minor thing, but apparently this company has already screened tenants for 40,000 rental units in BC, which is a significant number of places. One company after this came out did immediately say they're dropping certain, I think, one building in Vancouver. When pressed on this, both Horgan and Weaver issued statements going, oh, we didn't know that's what this was. Yeah, we're not okay with that. We're about renter rights and, like, not creepy internet companies that spy on your potential tenants, like some Black Mirror episode.
The fun of living in a sub 1% vacancy market, now with creepy technology.
Yeah. I mean, with the statements distancing themselves, the story's pretty much blown over, but it's one of those things that I think, you know, we're going to see more of these kind of things, as you point out, with the tight rental market and just...
Oh, there's a lot of horror stories out there.
So, you know, the premier can be excused for not totally knowing everyone he meets at an event. At least this wasn't like a accused... attempted terrorist like Jasper Atwal, if that was the right phrasing for that.
The Atwal bar is pretty low. Like, I'm not sure the premier gets congratulations for merely stepping over that.
I'm just saying, like, random people might show up at any event you are at as premier, and if you get pictured or you say something about them. I saw the premier also in the last couple weeks was under heavy criticism from some Jewish advocacy organizations because he had written a letter congratulating some imam, and the Jewish organizations were saying this imam said a bunch of anti-Semitic things in some of his speeches and demanded he retract his letter of congratulations, and there was some back and forth, and eventually he did. Things get tough when you're premier of the province. So, looks like he's made the right choice in distancing from certain now. Well, the last provincial story I wanted to touch on was, I think it was just today, the province released a report following a consultation they'd done on unbiased policing. This followed one of the missing murdered Indigenous women inquiries, I think the provincial one, that said we should take efforts to ensure that police and RCMP forces in the province have some training in unconscious bias, have some understanding of how to work with racialized and Indigenous communities, and try to reduce the racism that they sometimes get accused of. And it seems like the report actually went over well, because I did do this survey. It was one of probably 40 surveys that have been done now in the past 6 months. And it set out a number of recommendations and put forward ideas, and they seemed to all go over pretty well. Even one of the things that wasn't explicitly in there was reducing the number of street checks, the carding, essentially, where police just randomly stop someone and go, hey, do you have ID? Which is fucking dystopian. But the report brought that in and found people are pretty, like, less so. They're a bit split on that, but a still majority supported working to reduce that prevalence. And that's good news for the province, because the Globe and Mail just pointed out that Vancouver police might be kind of racist. Or at least they reported that Indigenous and Black Vancouverites have been disproportionately stopped by police. They found 16% of street checks last year involved people who are Indigenous, despite them only being 2% of the population. And 5% of the stops were Black Vancouverites, when 1% of Vancouver's population is Black. Vancouver police say, no, we can't be racist, because 57% of the stops were white people, and only 50% of Vancouverites are white.
Yeah, it's just still some work to do, for sure. And, you know, making our police the best they can be.
And that's exactly it. I think one of the keys with reports like this is it's not about saying each individual cop is a flaming racist bigot, but it's about making sure that the institution that we've given the right to use force over our citizens is above reproach, and that people trust it and have faith in it, because that's not really the case in a lot of communities right now. So there's work to be done.
Well, this week we also got a little more insight into what the national security threat that Canada poses is. And it turns out it's burning down the White House in 1812. So it came to light this week that on May 25th, Trump and Trudeau had spoken on the phone to talk about the new tariff situation. And, you know, Trudeau pressed him on the, seriously, we're a national security thing. And to which he quipped, didn't you guys burn down the White House? And, like, there's a part of me that is almost surprised Trump even knew what the War of 1812 was.
There's this theory that Trump is very much always thinking of the last thing he was told, or very recently, and that's what his position will be. And I wouldn't be surprised if someone in the White House or that he saw, I don't think it's a Fox News talking point regularly, but...
Even Fox News isn't dumb enough to try and argue 1812 means we're a security threat.
But I'm not saying anyone argued it was. I'm saying someone just mentioned that this was a war that the colony of Canada at the time, because we were still a British colony then, went to war with, or the U.S. went to war with it, and...
Well, yeah. I mean, the U.S. and Britain went to war when the U.S. declared war on Britain over a bunch of stuff, including impressment of American sailors. But point is, Canada wasn't even a country at the time. We were a smattering of colonies of Britain.
And so someone probably told Trump, hey, there was this war. That was a thing.
They burned the White House down.
Burned down the White House.
Which it was British who did it. Just to be clear, you know, it was the British forces that actually burnt the White House down. The Canadians were, you know, fighting around the Great Lakes area where, you know, the British sailed into Chesapeake Bay and screwed with the Americans for a while.
I watched a BuzzFeed video actually on this, one of their like bad histories or something, and they just talked about how kind of dickish the British were in that invasion, but also how the Americans just kind of didn't respond. And suddenly they were like, no, the Brits aren't going to sail right into DC. And then they did.
Have they not met the British Navy? Like, sailing a bunch of warships somewhere and fucking shit up was kind of the British MO for a long time.
Well, and especially hot off of the Napoleonic Wars.
Well, it was during the Napoleonic Wars. Like, it was smack dab in the middle of them. And that was actually what led to the war, in part, was the British impressing sailors to try and, you know, meet their recruitment targets for the war against Napoleon. And, you know, as far as the British were concerned, 1812 was kind of a sideshow.
Well, and this is all just kind of fun distraction, but it does highlight the fact that, I mean, we're in a trade war with this.
Yeah, and that Trump is kind of tearing apart the alliance system for very poorly thought out reasons.
Well, and it's clear he was doing that from day one, or would be doing that from day one, and yet Canada's approach since then has, at the federal level, as a federal government, has been almost like a soft version of appeasement. Like, let's go to events with Melania, and let's, I mean, no one knows where she is anymore, but they went and saw a play, and they tried to say, oh, we'll get along.
Well,
and
also...
then he did some speeches, but not like directly pointing at them, just being like, we're still an open country.
They have also done a really major lobbying campaign in the U.S., basically targeting anyone with any influence on trade or strong feelings on it or any elected representatives whose districts would be affected. So there's been a lot of work put into this.
But the public messaging has all been pretty sympathetic. And even following the announcement of the trade war, it was, how could they do this to us? We're friends.
I mean, the national security thing is pretty what the fuck. So yeah, we'll see how that goes. One thing I did see suggested this week by Scott Gilmore McLean's and picked up by a few American commentators as well, or at least discussing how, you know, the most effective way to pressure Trump would be to kind of treat them as we do the Russian oligarchs and really target the Trump businesses rather than American products. And, you know, take a not very normal tact when it comes to trade wars.
Yeah, I'm in favor. Does that mean we can tear the Trump sign down on the tower around the corner?
Yeah, it might be a little trickier, but yeah, it wouldn't make more sense than raising Canadians' costs to try and also pressure America. Plus, I think it would actually make Trump pay attention more.
Well, I'm sure as July 1st comes and our tariffs go into effect and we start seeing some effect of the U.S. tariffs, we'll have more to say on this, and undoubtedly Trump will say something else stupid. Mexico's having an election very soon that could bring radically different government in, or could, I don't know, keep the status quo. Lots of uncertainties, so good times. But one person who has some certainty now is Martine Ouellette, who knows for certain her party really doesn't like her. I think we talked when Mulcair got ousted with like a narrow vote against him, how rare it is for a party membership to really vote no on a leadership.
Yeah, and the general view is that basically anything under, what, 70-75% is considered like fatal for a leader. So keep that in mind when
Ouellette goes into this leadership review and gets a good 32%, not even a third, who say, yeah, we want you around. The irony of the whole thing is that the Bloc Québécois had a second vote where they asked people if they liked this idea of focusing on Quebec independence as a key priority of the Bloc Québécois, and something like two-thirds voted in favor of that, which was Martine Ouellette's raison d'etre as leader. So it's a, we like what you stand for, but we don't like you. It is a, it's not me, it's you kind of situation. So Ouellette immediately resigned, tearful, as that is a pretty big blow to your self-confidence, and I can't imagine. And since then, two Bloc Québécois MPs have returned to the party, Michel Boudrias and Simone Marcil. Hopefully I didn't butcher those too much.
A little bit.
I'm not Québécois. I don't speak much French.
I believe it's Boudrias.
But another five MPs are sticking with their splinter party. Notable former Bloc Québécois leader, I believe, Réal Fortin, said they're not interested in a like separatist party that has separatism at its core. So they're having a Quebec nationalist but not separatist party, which will, I'm sure, do great in the next election, as other splinters have happened in recent Canadian history that I can't remember. I know they've happened. I just don't remember who they were.
The, Strength in Democracy, right. I think it was, that came out of two MPs who defected from the Bloc Québécois.
I think one was New Democrat, or they followed later.
Okay.
But
yeah, there was two Strength in Democracy MPs in Parliament, and they did not do well in the next election.
The best part of that anecdote, though, is I think they even had a couple candidates in Ontario running for them.
Yeah, in the Franco-Ontario parts?
Potentially, that might be the strength there. But, you know, your Quebec nationalists just don't do well outside of Quebec, I guess. Or in it anymore. So the Bloc is once again leaderless, and I guess we'll have to go through another leadership race, which the last one picked Ouellette by default, I believe. So I don't think the tough times are over for the Bloc Québécois.
Probably not. And separatism itself doesn't seem to be quite the rallying cry it used to be. And I can't imagine this has helped. Well, one other federal politician who got a little more certainty this week was Kent Hare, who reported that the investigation into the harassment has completed, and that he will be back in caucus, although he is not returning to cabinet.
Hare had faced allegations over a number of comments and he had made in elevators with women, or being too touchy, and those kind of problematic elements. And the Liberals swiftly put him out of caucus, removed his cabinet positions, and launched this investigation. So he's undoubtedly happy to see it over. Doesn't seem like we know exactly what the investigation found yet, although this, that they brought him back into caucus suggests it wasn't a like
it wasn't
red
damning,
line.
Yeah.
But I think after you go through one of those investigations, it's hard to say, well, you're back into the inner circle now, unless you can really discount all of the allegations. So it might be that we never know the full story here, but I mean, this is the kind of story we're going to see more and more of as parties start to hold some accountability for harassment and other boys club type comments that have been around for way too long.
Well, so it's the final thing we're going to talk about. We started recording this basically right when polls closed in Ontario, and it is now 45 minutes later, and we've just checked the results for the first time. to find that there's a projected PC majority. So looks like Doug Ford is the new Ontario Premier.
Kathleen Wynne had conceded last weekend, just after we released the episode we recorded with John Michael McGrath, which was helpful of her to make our episode very relevant. Her hope was to hold on to enough MPs to hold either the NDP or the Conservatives to a minority. It looks like they're on the edge of party status, which is 8 seats in Ontario.
And that's what they're currently projected to win.
It's not good for Wynne no matter what. I think when she conceded, it was pretty much a, and I'm probably leaving as leader. But she didn't say that.
It would be really hard to stay as leader after going from a majority government to edge of party status. Although I'm trying right now, it looks like she probably will keep her seat, but it's not certain at this point.
It does give a confirmation to the polls that were pretty much suggesting that it would be a tight race between the NDP and Conservatives, but the voting efficiency would give the edge to the Conservatives overall. And it looks like, I think it was around 75 when we looked, seats for the Conservatives to
37 New Democrat, 8 Liberal, and a Green. Yeah, looks like Mike Schreiner has been elected, and not by a small margin either. As of right now, with 57 of the 80 polls in the Riding of Guelph reporting, he's at 45%. So I can't imagine the second place New Democrat at 21 is going to make up that distance. So guess congrats to him. And it looks like the Green parties are kind of on the upswing countrywide.
The Green Party of Ontario had been trying for a while to get Schreiner elected, and I think they've taken the Elizabeth May proven approach now of throw all your eggs in one basket, get that seat, and grow from there. I mean, the most successful is the BC Greens, who are up to 3 after they had won from Andrew Weaver. So Guelph was where they've been working. I know even the federal Greens have been working on a Guelph seat for a while.
Yeah, it's a fairly friendly area for them.
And beyond that, I don't know too much about the Ontario Greens. I do know that they're the only party that says they would work to disestablish the Catholic school system and roll it into the public system, and I'm in support of that. So good for Schreiner, but I still don't think that's happening under Premier Doug Ford.
Yeah, and unlike here in BC, that one, you know, that small green voice in the legislature isn't going to move things very much.
This is a real Pyrrhic victory for Andrea Horvath, sort of a Jack Layton, did the best we ever did, but still only just came into, like, opposition of a Conservative majority. So what does a Doug Ford premier mean for federal relations between the provinces and Trudeau?
It's going to get a lot rougher, that's for sure. And the long-term trend has been that the party in Ottawa doesn't match the party in Queen's Park. So on one hand, this is not surprising. But on the other hand, I expect that it will be more tense than it usually has been, especially as Doug Ford has promised to fight carbon pricing, which means he'll be joining in with the Saskatchewan challenge to it. And who knows, at the rate we're going, we'll probably have Alberta doing it when Jason Kenney gets elected. So yeah, that's going to be a tough fight, I think. Or at least it'll be a noisy fight. I can't imagine they're going to win on it, but carbon tax is not to go away from the national conversation anytime soon.
Well, and Ontario's had a cap-and-trade system, and they've been working to move off gas-fired and some other carbon-producing energy systems. Not always in the most affordable way.
Or the most above board way either, as the gas plant scandal alluded to.
But it's a big shift, and it's going to be a big change for Ontario to go from that to not giving a flying rat's ass about climate change and instead focusing on, well, who knows, because Doug Ford didn't really release a platform, as far as I know. He talked about Buck a Beer and cutting like 10% of the budget without losing a job or something like that. So
yeah, Yeah, so he has no costed platform. He's promised to roll back the cap and trade system, which was implemented 2017. So it's actually fairly new. They announced it previously, but it taken a few years to get pieces into place. So yeah, that's going to be interesting, that's for sure. Don't expect good things to happen with the Ontario debt, and the province has been facing debt problems for quite a while. And despite the PCs running on that for several elections, now they somehow managed to find the least credible leader on that.
I think it's also bad news broadly for conservative movements across the country. Like, yeah, I'm sure they're excited to see a win, but in terms of the discourse we're going to see going forward, this is a vindication of the populist but thin on policy, just attack everything, yell fake news, and that Trump-style politics in Canada. Vancouver, I don't think, is going to see that now that Glenn Chernin's not going to be the mayor or candidate of the NPA. And the provincial level, luckily we have Andrew Wilkinson, who's like the exact opposite of Doug Ford in terms of conservatism. But Jason Kenney's election is coming up, and I could see him. He's not the same as Doug Ford. He's a much more institutional conservative, but I can see him playing those cards.
Yeah, I think we'll see him lean into that for sure.
And we could see Scheer go the same way. Not that he'd be effective at it.
Yeah, I mean, he's already hinted at that a bit with some of his rival media connections and whatnot, although he's also downplayed that a bit, but wouldn't surprise me to see that pop up in the upcoming election.
Do we see Doug Ford taking any pipeline positions?
I expect he'll, if he does take them, and I give there's a decent chance he does, he'll be pro-pipeline.
And so it's that kind of, it's a shift. Like, Ontario's Canada's biggest province, and for them to go from Kathleen Wynne, who brought in progressive sex education, who tried to put the, like, happy spin on Ontario even while there were the scandals going on, to Doug Ford, who I don't think anyone expects the scandals to go away.
No.
They'll just be like, well, obviously they go with him, and it just perplexes me that 40% of people are happy to vote for
this. There's this weird thing in politics where, like, if you get a reputation as scandal prone, like, subsequent scandals don't hurt you as bad, and it's like people just shrugged off whatever the latest Trump news is. Like, oh, whatever, it's Trump being Trump. And you get a bit of that with the Fords, too.
Well, and it's a way of, rather than apologizing for scandals, which then, like, validates that people should be upset, it's just doubling down as a way to avoid the controversy. Or just even brush it off and say, yeah, whatever. It's just dumb. Don't spend your time on that. And the media doesn't know how to respond to that. Well, I'm sure we'll have more to say as the final results come through and shakes out into what this means politically across the country.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll be talking about this for a while now, because this will undoubtedly shape national politics as well as, you know, Ontario provincial politics, obviously, for quite a while right now. As we're signing off here at 6:57 Pacific time, PCs have 72, NDP 40, Liberals 8. So the NDP's gained a bit since we checked the results at the start of the segment, but definitely looks like that PC majority is not just projected, but going to come through at this point. Any final thoughts?
This is going to be bad for Vancouver housing prices, since we're going to have a flood of people from Toronto trying to get here.
Yeah, I don't know. People say that every time a Republican gets elected, and you don't get that flood of people moving to Canada. And I don't think you'll get that happening in Toronto either.
I did see Jen Gerson tweeting out that Alberta has a high vacancy rate in offices and would be very welcoming to Toronto refugees, to which Shannon Waters replied, yeah, until you elect Jason Kenney. It was a bit more subtle than that, and I'm sort of butchering both of their tweets, but since we didn't write down a best of BC poly, I'll just give it that exchange as one thing I enjoyed today on Twitter. So I'm sorry, Ontario. Better luck next time.
And that has been Politos. Find links to stories we mentioned in the show notes at politos.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Politos Pod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/bloodcoast. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send to us. Thanks for listening.